right. The time is now 9:31, and I will call this meeting on the Committee of Behavior Analysts to order. Ms. Pacman, can we get a roll call?
Certainly, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Rates?
Present.
And Dr. Stenhoff?
Here.
A quorum is established.
Excellent. Thank you. I wanted to just take a moment to thank board staff. I think the last month and a half has been quite a challenging arena to navigate when it comes to regulatory bodies, the information that's coming in from the governor's office, all of the circumstances related to the state of emergency that we're in right now with COVID-19. And I feel that they've done a remarkable job in making sure that information is still coming to us in a timely fashion, that applications are organized and set up and ready to review. We're still being provided plenty of time to review the information. And so thank you to board staff for all of their hard work, because I know that this has not been easy. It's been quite the transition for everybody. I also would like to thank the committee members, because we have had some of our busiest meetings the last couple of meetings. We have a good amount of applications coming in on a regular basis, and I know that there's a lot of work that goes into preparing these meetings, and I am very appreciative of the work that you guys do for the committee, and I know that that is echoed across the full board, who is also appreciative of the committee work, because some of that work does aid in reducing some of their workload as well. So thank you for that as well. I know the board staff has been looking into video conferencing to kind of address some of the lack of in-person meetings for full board, and I would like to thank board staff for their work on that, because I think that's going to be immensely helpful, especially when it comes to full board meetings, but maybe something in the future that we can look at for committee meetings as well, to kind of get some face-to-face contact. I appreciate all of the work that's been done by board staff to get that kind of tested and approved and all that good stuff. All right, I will now move to agenda item number 4, approval of minutes. March 30th, 2020 regular session minutes. Do we have a motion to approve?
Madam Chair, I make a motion to approve the minutes.
Excellent. Do we have a second? I will go ahead and second that.
Sorry,
thank you. No, you're okay. We have a motion and a second. So those meeting minutes have been, oh, can we get a vote? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. We will now move to agenda item number 5, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation to the board pertaining to the approval of behavior analyst applicants. It's my understanding that we do have Ms. Weller on the phone. So if we could go ahead and start with number 11, Shannon Weller. Dr. Rates, you are the lead on this case. Can you please provide us a summary?
Yes. thank you. So we did make a request to Ms. Weller for some additional information regarding her initial application in question 12, where she did indicate yes. She had initially given us a small statement related to question 12, explaining what had occurred in 2008, but we asked for some additional information, and that was provided. The additional information that was provided was a little bit different than what was on the statement we initially received from Ms. Weller, although in terms of where the charges stand, that is correct and was resolved as described in her initial statement. when reviewing all of the documents. Again, I think the only question that I would have moving forward is just why there was a discrepancy between the statement that we received and then the documents that we received more recently.
Excellent. Would you like to ask that question to Ms. Weller? It might be helpful if she doesn't have the documentation in front of her to provide which discrepancy you are referring to, but she is on the phone, so you are welcome to ask her.
Certainly. Thank you for that. So my only question, Ms. Weller, would just be the discrepancy between your statement about a keychain that was found in your possession at school versus the report, which indicates that there were other items that were identified in your purse at school. A keychain is not what was mentioned. So I would just want to better understand the discrepancy between those two reports.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Shannon Weller. I was able to review the reports as well. I wasn't aware that they were necessary documentation, so I actually didn't pull or review any of them until after they were requested, and it took some time to obtain them to them in a different state. And at the time, I personally was going through some trauma. My mom was going through cancer, and she had just passed recently after that. So if I'm being just completely honest and transparent, my memory for those days were kind of limited. I think I blocked a lot of it out. The keychain was the paraphernalia, so I don't know if I maybe didn't make that clear in my original statement. I apologize for that discrepancy. And that's all I had from my memory. I even called my dad and asked what he remembered from the incident as well. And it did seem that in the report there was also a small amount of marijuana in there as well, along with the paraphernalia keychain. So that is the discrepancy that I'm aware of. And that was just a mistake and oversight on my end as far as how much detail was provided.
Ms. Weller, just to clarify, was the keychain a purple pipe keychain? Like, is it something, maybe something? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Race, I think that it might just be the difference in the language of what the police department would call the paraphernalia versus, like, I mean, either way, it was paraphernalia. So hopefully that clarifies.
Yep,
I appreciate that. Are there any other questions from Ms. Weller?
I would just say thank you for that clarification, and thank you for being here and for submitting everything. And I do appreciate that. It seems that since that time, there haven't been any other incidents, and appreciate that that was a difficult time in your life. So thank you for sharing that with us and for getting us additional information that was required.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And I appreciate your understanding with the discrepancy and as I navigate this, you know, tricky process.
Does anybody else have any other questions? My only other question is, Weller, this was in 2008 and you were a minor, correct?
Yes, correct. I was 15 at the time. Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to just clarify that for the record, because I think, you know, it makes a difference sometimes.
I wasn't even sure if I needed to disclose it. I just wanted to disclose everything that I was aware of. That way, if anything didn't come up that I didn't address, I'd rather be fully transparent.
Absolutely. And we appreciate, I'm going to echo what Dr. Raitt said. We appreciate how quickly you got us the information. I know sometimes it's hard to navigate what type of details are needed and what aren't. Once that clarification was provided, you got us the information, and we appreciate you being on the call. That's another thing that we would encourage applicants to do, because a lot of issues can be resolved by just simply asking questions. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for giving us all this information and for coming forth and making sure that we had all of the proper information. What's going to happen now is that, you know, if the committee agrees to move it forward to the full board, then it will be seen by the full board next week, and then you will board staff will reach out to you at the end of that meeting or that, you know, that following Monday. So so hang tight.
Yeah.
And we will get this process rolling. Dr. Raitt does have I believe a recommendation to move forward with recommendation for approval, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Excellent. Are there any other questions?
Wonderful. Thank
or
you
concerns?
All.
Thank you, Ms. Waller. Hearing none, we will go ahead and move. I just want to check, there's no other applicants on the phone, correct? All right, we're going to go ahead and move to applicant number one, Allison Dillon. I am the lead on that applicant, so I will give a summary. Ms. Dillon passed her exam in February of 2020. She graduated from Northern Arizona University, Master's of Education, Special Education, in July of 2019. She did her supervision here in Arizona with a licensed supervisor from the periods of December of 2018 to November of 2019, and did a total of 1,500 hours. I reviewed her application, and I have no concerns with the application and would refer it to full board for approval. Does anybody have any questions, comments, or concerns? Hearing none, we will go to applicant number two, Cole Goudreau. Dr. Davey is the lead. We do have one recusal. Dr. Raitt is recused, but we do still have a quorum. So if Dr. Davey, you could provide us a summary of that application.
Absolutely. Madam Chair and committee, Dr. Davey, can I make a quick statement?
Of course.
Yes, please.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, I just wanted to disclose that I was Mr. Goudreau's instructor during his graduate program, but feel that I can review this application without bias.
Excellent. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes. So we have the application for Cole Goudreau before us. Application was filled out in its entirety. Individual who attended Arizona State University Master's of Science program, subject of applied behavior analysis. On the application, I would also say before I get into that part, application included adequate supervision by individuals that were verified to be operating in the state of Arizona under our current licensure act. Of note, on the application, Mr. Goudreau did check yes on number 12, which was regard to either being currently awaiting trial or having pled no contest or guilty to a felony misdemeanor other than a minor traffic offense or a minor diversion program in lieu of prosecution. And so with that came several items for us to review. The individual, Cole Goudreau, came forward and stated that in 1999 he was charged with a DUI. I would point out to the committee members that was 10 years ago. He had his license suspended. He did spend some jail time following that. He was 17 years old, a minor at that point, had some extenuating circumstances in his life that most likely have led to some poor decisions on his part. He owns those in his document, PDF page 3 of 52. Then second, in 2011, he was charged with urinating in public while in Scottsdale. He again takes responsibility for that. He worked through the process through the courts and set up a small fine and essentially states in this document that he was embarrassed and had learned from this lesson. Again, this is now close to 9 years ago. I saw that board staff, Kathy in particular, went back and forth with regard to fingerprint cards there was documentation provided with regard to the individual's fingerprint card. A copy of that can be found being issued past the dates in question for number 12, issue date of 8-4-2016, page 8 of your PDF. You will also see that background check was run and a few other items that are in here. You know, even with the information that's provided dating back to 1999 and 2011, the individual has been, appears to have been on a straightforward path, working towards his education, working towards his ultimate certification as a BCBA and now seeks licensure in our state. With the issues that are there, but having reviewed the information, I still feel it's prudent to move this individual's application forward. I would welcome the comments of my fellow colleagues on the board and the committee.
Excellent. Thank you. Are there any questions, comments, or concerns from any committee members? Hearing none, we will recommend Mr. Goodrow for approval to the full board. The applicant number three is Haley Rose. Dr. Rates, you are the lead on that application. Can you please provide us an overview?
Yes, thank you. And I will note that Haley Rose does work for the same organization that I work for. However, we have not spent any significant time together and work in different departments. So I feel comfortable being able to review the application. Haley Rose received her BCBA in February of this year. She graduated with her master's from Ball State in May of 2008. She received a total of 1,600 hours of supervision at SARC across three separate supervisors between the time frame of January 2008 and June of 2019, or 2018 and June of 2019. In reviewing the application, I did not see any questions of concern and would recommend that this move forward to the full board and would welcome any comments or questions from my colleagues.
Excellent. Thank you. Are there any questions or comments for Ms. Rose's application? Hearing none, we will move on to applicant number four, Heather Ramsden. Dr. Stenhoff, you are the lead on this application. Can you please provide us a summary?
Sure. Ms. Ramsden received her BCBA in May of 2017, graduated in 2015 from Northern Arizona University with a Master of Arts in Psychology, and received a graduate certificate in positive behavior support. She received 1,864 hours of supervision under Jasmine Daniel in Vecina Cano in California, which does not have a licensure requirement. I didn't note any concerns with the application and would recommend to be forwarded to the board for approval.
Excellent, thank you. Do any committee members have any questions? Hearing none, we will move to applicant number five, Jessica Goss. I am the lead, so I will provide an overview. Jessica passed her exam in February of 2020. She graduated with a Master's of Education with an ABA certificate. The ABA certificate was from Lipscomb University in May of 2019. Supervision occurred in Tennessee by a licensed behavior analyst for just over 1,500 hours from the periods of September 2019 to November of 2019. After reviewing her application, I had no concerns and would recommend referring her application to the full board for approval. Anybody have any questions or comments? Hearing none, we will move to applicant number six, Joel Mattielli. Dr. Davey, you are the lead on this application. Can you please provide us a summary?
Madam Chair and committee members, I just want to note that I worked at the same agency as Mr. Mattiella several years ago, but I was not his supervisor, so I feel that can be his application without bias. So.
Yeah, this is Dr. Davey. I'll make the same statement that I have known Mr. Mattiella in former positions over the course of my career in the state of Arizona. As early, I think, as working with Joel Mottola, in the early 2000s. That being said, I don't believe I have any bias towards this individual, and I've not had professional contact with him for at least probably the last 6-7 years. With that, Madam Chair, I will begin with a summary. Applicant comes forward seeking licensure in the state of Arizona, completed the application, went through Arizona State University's graduate certificate program. Major subject area was an overview of ASD, autism spectrum disorders, as well as curriculum and instruction. The individual completed application in his entirety, including supervisors that are licensed and available to provide supervision to those seeking licensure in the state of Arizona. They also fit our criteria, and so no issues around that. That being said, the individual did check box number 12, again, seeking information around previous or current felonies or misdemeanors other than minor traffic offenses, where the individual may have been prosecuted or in lieu prosecution, went into a diversion program. Incidents are provided in detail, starting on page 3 of the PDF. We have one at age 20. Applicant was arrested for possession of marijuana and paraphernalia, entered a treatment and assessment a screening center. All charges were dropped and completed his court-ordered process in 2002, 18 years ago. Second incident, which multitude of information is provided in subsequent pages of the PDF, occurred in January of 2017, so approximately 3 years ago, three and a half years ago, where the applicant had a dispute with his roommate. Because of that, he essentially engaged in property destruction and was arrested by the police department for disorderly conduct. It appears through the documents that were provided that all the individuals that were involved in the incident, there were three, a roommate, the applicant, Joel Martiella's girlfriend, and then the applicant himself, have provided statements with regard to the situation. Those statements more or less coincide with the documentation provided by the Tempe Police Department with regard to the events that surrounded that night, as well as kind of the overall mood or environment that brought about that behavior. I would say in reading through the information provided by all three, as well as the information provided by the Tempe Police Department, and the fact that this has been completely resolved, that I don't really harbor any further concerns based on the single event. I do welcome comments from my fellow committee members with regard to this applicant. I would move to pass this along to the full board for approval. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Davey. Are there any committee members with any questions or comments? Hearing none, we will move on to applicant number 7, Kimberly Dom. Dr. Rates, you are the lead on this application. Can you please provide us an overview?
Yes, thank you. Kimberly Dom received her BCBA in February of this year. She completed a master's at Florida Institute of Technology between January of 2019 and December of 2019. She also received her supervision at SEEK for just over 1,500 hours. One note on this application is that in reviewing her supervision, it seems that only 800 hours of the total amount of hours reported occurred
after she started her master's program. So in reviewing supervision, it seemed that a good portion of her supervision occurred prior to beginning her master's program, which I believe cannot be counted towards that 1,500, but would be interested in hearing from other committee members if I am interpreting that correctly.
Thank you. I'm wondering if this is another scenario of the individual possibly being a BCABA. I mean, we wouldn't know that, but I think that, you know, the recommendation that I would have is to perhaps send a letter requesting clarification related to the matter to see if that clarification is provided in a way that's satisfactory. But I think you are correct that the hours can only count after the start of a master's, with the exception of the hours that until, I believe, October of this last year, the BCABA hours were able to roll, be included in that 1,500. If you recall, the BACB did change that in October for all new applicants applying for certification. So if an individual was able to get their application in by October, then they, you know, would have been able to count their BCABA hours. Anything after that, I believe the BACB is now requiring the full 1,500 hours to be after the onset of the master's degree as well.
Thank you for that additional information and clarification. And I would agree, if we can reach out and get some additional information about whether or not that was indeed the case for this applicant, and if those hours were a part of the BCABA, then I think review this.
Madam Chair, this is Kathy.
Yes, Ms. Folks.
On page 24 of 28, it has her BACB certificate registry information, and it does list her BCABA and when she was a registered behavior technician. I don't know if that helps any. If I'm remembering correctly, and I could verify this, I do believe this may have been the applicant that some of her supervision hours were by a supervisor who was not licensed in the state where the supervision took place, and so she was using her BCABA hours. I did not put that correspondence in the file, but I could check my computer while you're moving on and see if that is her or not, and I could post the information.
Yeah, let me check dates one more time, because I do think that even if that were the case, it looks like at least the hours that we have here and her work experience is all done under a licensed.
Yes, that's correct. She, if she's the one I think that she is, because I know there was one applicant that I had discussions with, and I think I had, we had emailed you specifically about BCABA hours.
Yes.
At one point. And I'll need to do some research and look back at my correspondence with her and see if this is the individual. Okay. I may already have correspondence about it, but if I don't, then we'll do the first additional information request for that.
Okay. So in looking even at that and her transcript, I think a request for additional information is still going to be warranted, because we can look at her transcripts then from when she would have started, because the technical terminology isn't the onset of the master's, but the onset of the approved coursework, which it looks like she started, at least from what I'm seeing, is fall of 2017, and she's requesting hours dated back to 2015. So we would still need, I think, to address Dr. Rates' concern, we would still need a transcript reflecting that 2015 to 2017, which is possible if she was a BCABA. It looks like her original certification as a BCABA, though, wasn't until 2019. So I think there's still some clarification that would be needed, even though the BCABA hours would be allowed to be used in this particular circumstance. Even under those circumstances, I'm still seeing some date discrepancies that don't align with the current transcript that we have, which appears to be her graduate transcript. I'm not sure if there was anything that was done in undergraduate that would count, but if there was, that could be resolved by the applicant supplying us the undergraduate transcripts as well. So I think we would still, even with you, the information that you have, Ms. Folks, if this is that same individual, I think we would still need to see undergrad transcripts to confirm that those hours that were done starting in May of 2015. Did I see that right? Maybe I was looking at the wrong page. Hold on. It's Marja. Oh, no, her hours, I was looking at her work experience. I apologize. Her hours started in June of 2017, but her coursework appears to have started in fall of 2017. So there might be some hours. That would not count. And some that would. So I think that, I don't know, I think I would still feel comfortable moving forward with a request for information to request that the applicant supply us an explanation of that date discrepancy still. Even if the response is that she was a BCABA, I think we still need to have it for the record. Obviously, unless our other committee members have other questions, but.
All right, so Madam Chair, this is Kathy.
Yes.
So the request of the committee is for the information is you want an undergrad transcript and whether or not she was a BCABA at the time of her supervision under Ms. Schinbeckler at SEEK? No, I'm sorry, it's the other one, Ms. Gonzalez.
It's, Huzetka is who started supervision in June of 2017, but the coursework didn't begin until fall of 2017. So what we would need is an explanation or documentation. Now, I'll tell you that some universities have some interesting dates for their semesters, especially if they're on 8-week cycles or what have you. So we're looking at just a transcript that says fall 2017, but what date that actually started, I don't really know. And so the discrepancy really is between that June date and whenever fall was. Am I seeing that right, Dr. Rates? Is that?
Can you refer me to the page where you see fall of 2017?
Yeah, let me pull it up with pages. It's the actual FIP transcript.
Correct.
So the transfer credit, she started behavior analytic classes in fall of 2017. I'm sorry, I'm trying to pull it up. It doesn't show me page numbers on the website, so I'm trying to pull it up in CVS.
That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
is Kathy, Madam Chair.
Yes, Ms. Folks.
While you guys are looking for that, they need a minimum of 1,500 hours, correct?
That is correct.
And on page 11 of 28, we have a verification from Ms. Gonzalez for 728.25 hours, and then a verification from Ms. Shinbeckler on page 16 for 800 hours. I know I'm bad at math, but isn't that over 1,500 hours for those two?
Yep. Yep. I would agree. So essentially, she's already submitted the additional documentation.
And I guess I'm just maybe, and again, I may be interpreting the transcript incorrectly, but I thought that when I looked at it, it did not start until fall of 2019, but perhaps I am missing some information here. So if she did have that transfer earlier, then that would certainly count for those hours, but I guess I did not see that.
Trying to look for the transcript. It's the So when you're on page 9 and you look at the transfer credit accepted by the institution, she started her behavior analytic classes in fall of 2017. It's in the left-hand column. She's got fall of 2017, spring of 2018.
There it is. Thank you. That is so very small, and I did not see that. I apologize.
Yeah, and it's confusing. So, Ms. Folks, it looks like this transcript already pulls the undergrad transcript we would be needing. So it actually looks like maybe it is complete.
Yes, if she had that transfer in 17, then she would have, correct, enough hours. I did not see that transfer, so thank you for catching that.
And it actually looks like it may have started in summer of 17. It just looked weird because it just says continuing ed, but that can just be a transfer. So it does look like even the June hours. So
then, yes, she would have enough with those two combined, correct? And I apologize for taking the committee's time and for missing that detail there.
I actually appreciate it because sometimes I feel like the applicants are so organized and so perfect, we're just moving through them, and I'm like, what if we missed something? So I appreciate you catching that, and I appreciate the discussion on it. I think it's a good reminder for that funky BCABA transition.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So with that, then I would recommend that we move this forward to the full board.
Excellent. Are there any questions or comments from other committee members? Then we will move along. Thank you, Mrs. Folks. I do get what you were saying now. So I appreciate it. And yes, this application is complete. So thank you for that and for the clarification. All right, we will now move to applicant number 8, Lachey Holmes. Dr. Senhoff, you are the lead on this application. Can you please provide us an overview?
Sure. Ms. Holmes became a BCBA in February of this year. She graduated in 2017 from Northern Arizona University with a Master of Education in Special Ed, Positive Behavior Support and Autism. She received just over 2,400 hours of supervision under Christina Bartel, who's a licensed behavior analyst in the state. I did not know any concerns, and I'd recommend it be moved forward to the board for approval.
Excellent. Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments from the committee members? Hearing none, we will move forward to applicant number 9, Leah Shapiro. I am the lead on this case, so I will provide an overview. Ms. Shapiro passed her exam in December of 2006. She graduated with a master's in education from Indiana Purdue University in 2005, a behavior analysis certificate from Southern Illinois University in 2006. She was supervised from May 2004 to May 2006 in Indiana, and her total supervision hours was 1,500 hours. She did note on page number one, question number five, that she is licensed in good standing in Texas. We, board staff, were able to verify that. I have here that on page number four, item number 15, there is a discrepancy between the grad date, that the grad certificate date that is listed, and what her transcripts have. So it's listed as completed in August of 2006, but her transcripts do not list that. I'm not clear if the matriculation date that she lists here states December of 2004 or August of 2004, but neither one of them match the transcripts. So I think we need to get that cleared up, because depending on what date it started would depend on whether some of the supervision experience would count. Having said that, Ms. Shapiro, on page number five, question number 19, answered yes to completing 270 hours. This is not reflected on her transcripts, nor was it a standard by the BACB during that time period. So I did go ahead and look at her transcripts to make sure that there wasn't a bridge course that was possibly completed. I'm not seeing one. I'm only seeing the five courses that were allowable at that time, but unfortunately do not meet the rule for the 270 hours. And then on page number nine, question number eight was answered as no. This is the supervisor experience form. There was, at the time that supervision occurred, there was the BACB allowed for individuals with their doctorate in behavior analysis but not certified to still conduct conduct supervision. And so therefore she was not supervised by a certified behavior analyst as well. So I did have several questions for Ms. Shapiro. Unfortunately she's not on the phone, but I do, this was a very difficult application to read. I noted her current work experience, and I'm aware of that particular company coming to Arizona. And, you know, one of the things that I think has been extremely frustrating, both as somebody who is heavily involved in training programs here in Arizona, but also in the crisis programs, in the access work groups, we have a huge need for behavior analysts that have experience outside of just your traditional early intervention autism. And this individual is coming forth with some of that experience, coming forth with a place of work that starts to really put opportunities for additional training that is vastly needed here in the state. But unfortunately, despite how much needed her services are, and I do also have to add that, you know, I think it's less than 30% of BCBI certificates have been certified for greater than 6 years. And so when you look at it that way, it's kind of, for me personally, a little frustrating because we've got a very young field, and those that have years and years of experience just unfortunately aren't eligible for licensure. And unfortunately, I welcome the feedback from the rest of the committee, but I don't know how, with number five and number nine, I really don't know how we would be able to move forward with licensure. I did check her licensure eligibility in Texas. That is dated January of 2020. So, you know, my first thought was maybe she'd be eligible under universal recognition. Unfortunately, that's, you know, not the case as it stands today. But perhaps in 2021, if she establishes residency, she may be eligible. I think, you know, she's obviously welcome, and I encourage her to come to the state and practice under a licensed psychologist or behavior analyst. However, at this time, my recommendation would be to request that the full board allow her the opportunity to withdraw her application. Any questions or comments?
Madam Chair, I don't know if this is more of a clerical issue, but on page 4 of the PDF documents, it's item listed number 23 of experience and behavior analysis. I just noted that 3 of the 5 addresses listed there are incomplete. The street addresses listed, the city and state were not listed for 3 of the 5 of those. So I don't know if that needs to be changed or if that's even an issue. So.
Well, and I'm glad that you brought that up because I had a very similar question regarding, you know, there's a couple of other clerical issues in the application, like the dates listed for the start of the grad program and the completion of the certificate. So my question for board staff, aligned with Dr. Stenhoff's question, is that something we would bother getting cleaned up just so that we have all of the accurate information, or do we just move forward with the recommendation to the full board to allow for her to withdraw her application? Because I agree there's just some funky clerical things that might need to just be cleaned up for the record, but wasn't sure how board staff would address that if our recommendation is going to be to allow the applicant to withdraw.
This is Jean Galvin. I think if you're going to recommend or allow that she withdraw, then I would just leave the application as is. You might note in the letter pointing out that if she were to resubmit her application at some point, there are issues that would need to be, you know, clarified or corrected.
Okay. Perfect. We appreciate that. Dr. Stenhoff, did that address your question as well?
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Ms. Galvin, would you like for us to make a motion on this one separate from the others?
Sure, that would be helpful to keep the record clear.
Absolutely. So at this time, I would like to make a motion to recommend to the full board that Ms. Shapiro's application unfortunately does not meet the statutory requirements for the state of Arizona. And at this time, we would like to offer her the opportunity to withdraw her application. I believe that's in like 14 days or whatever the standard of that is. We would like to give her the opportunity to withdraw her application so that she is not penalized and can reapply at a time when perhaps she does meet the requirements in the state. And that is a motion. Do we have a second?
This is Dr. Davey. I'll second that motion.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. All right. We will move on now.
Madam Chair, this is Kathy.
Yes. Yes, Ms. Falk.
Was that a roll call vote or was that a voice vote? Because if it's a recommending denial, Jean, I think it needs a roll call vote.
It was a motion to allow her to withdraw, and it wasn't a denial, so it would not need a roll call.
Okay,
thank
great.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you asking that clarification. All right, we will move now to applicant number 10, Rachel Zvarek. Dr. Dave, you are the lead on this application. Can you please provide us an overview?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So Rachel Zvarek comes forward seeking licensure in the state of Arizona. She completed her application and submitted it for our review. She has worked through Ball State University, where she received her master's in applied behavior analysis with an emphasis in autism. Her major subject area was applied behavior analysis. She received her supervised experience at seek in Arizona from 2017 through 2019. She has provided information from two supervisors that are licensed in the state of Arizona. Both of them completed their application with regard to their attestation to supervising this individual in the state of Arizona during the time in which they held a licensure, as well as the ability from the BACB to provide supervision. Upon review of this, I found no issues with the individual's application and would move to have it go forward.
Excellent. Thank you. Do any other committee members have any questions or comments? Hearing none, I will go ahead and provide an overview. That we have recommended a review by the full board with recommendation of approval for Ms. Weller, Ms. Dillon, Mr. Goudreau, Mrs. Ramsden, Mrs. Goss, Mr. Mattielli, Ms. Doms, Ms. Holmes, Ms. Zarek, and Ms. Weller. Do we have a motion?
I so move.
We have a second?
I'll second.
I'm going to go ahead and have Dr. Stenhoff noted for the record for the second, Dr. Davey for the motion. All in favor state aye.
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 And we'll note again for the record that Ms. Rates is recused from Mr. Goudreau. We will now move to item number 5B, Behavior Analyst Application for Licensure by Universal Recognition. Dr. Stenhoff, you were the lead on this case. This is for Miriam Young. Can you please provide us an overview?
Sure. Ms. Young's been licensed in Washington State since 2018, which satisfies the adopted substantive policy statement that requires an applicant to be licensed in another state for at least 12 months. She provided evidence of her residency with her motor vehicle registration. I didn't note any concerns with this application. I'd recommend that it be moved forward to the board for approval.
Any questions or comments? Dr. Stenhoff, can you make a motion, or is that a motion?
I'll make a motion. I recommend it, but I'll make a motion that move forward to the board for approval.
Excellent, and I will second that. All in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Aye. Oh, please indicate approval. I guess you could just indicate anything, right? please indicate agreement of the motion by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
All right. That is four ayes for approval. Motion carries. We will move now to item number six. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding COVID-19-related board actions taken on license and supervision waivers, temporary licenses, and provisional licenses. Ms. Pagnon, can you please provide the committee a summary?
Yes, Madam Chair. I supplied you with the information that where we are posting the series of license waivers, temporary license opportunities for opportunities for both psychologists and behavior analysts, and a provisional license opportunity for psychologists that the board recently enacted. It's an expansive list, but we wanted to summarize this material in one place because board staff is fielding a lot of questions relative to, you know, is the board granting any waivers or any accommodations given the current pandemic. So this is an opportunity for committee members to ask questions of that material, discuss it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Committee members, are there any questions or comments related to the materials provided to you on the COVID-19 actions? I have just one comment, and that is, again, to thank the board staff. One of the things that I think happens in kind of the state of emergency that a lot of people don't have the opportunity to experience unless you're in this position is that the governor does have the ability to rapidly fire executive orders out that require the board staff to strategically get board members in place and actions moving as quickly as possible to address the state of emergency. I also would like to note, just for the committee's awareness, that the full board has had emergency meetings to be able to address these issues, and I am personally pleased with the actions to continue continuity beyond kind of what could be potentially an abrupt stop of the state of emergency. That's one of the things, and I'll talk about it in later agenda items, that seems to be a difficulty with the state of emergency is a lot of the verbiage of policies and rules are coming out as, hey, as soon as the state of emergency is over, these things are going to change. And so I commend the board on proactively considering that when the state of emergency is over, there's still going to need to be a transition period for the public receiving services, for the psychologist stepping in and coming out of retirement or what have you and helping, the behavior analyst stepping in and helping, that there's going to be a need to transition back to the rules prior to all of these executive orders. And so I personally appreciate that because I'm watching in a lot of other arenas where everything is just like, well, once the governor lifts the emergency, then all of this goes away. And I'm concerned about that, obviously. And so I wanted the committee to be aware that the board, the full board has done a really good job in making sure that there is an abrupt stop at the end of the state of emergency, but rather the verbiage that you'll note on a lot of these actions allows for transition times to ensure success. So I appreciate that. All right, any other questions or comments? Hearing none, we will move on to item number 7, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding BACB supervision frequency requirements. Ms. Pacanon, I'm actually going to claim the pregnancy brain on this one, and I wanted to turn to you to confirm once again so that I have the right understanding of why we have this agenda item.
Of course, Madam Chair. I'm going to try. I can't claim a pregnancy brain as an excuse, but I do believe there was some mention of this in the previous meeting. Turning to the minutes really quickly to see if that illuminates my understanding, too. I do know that this is a carryover item from a discussion that you held at the most recent CBA meeting. So let's look at the minutes and see
okay. What
they tell us.
Ms. Pacanon, I do recall that meeting. I wanted to make sure that's what it was. So essentially we had a circumstance in which an applicant was not observed through the course of their supervision. We have in our in our rules under supervision, we have two sections. One states under independent field work that the supervision frequency is to occur at a frequency that is allowed by the BACB. But then when you go further into what supervision entails, it does have verbiage that just says that supervision observations must occur. And so I think the confirmation, I think the clarification and just wanting to kind of wrap it up and make sure that everybody's on the same page with kind of the intent of that rule would be that we are interpreting those two sections to essentially say that the standards that are present today by the BACB are the standards that we are accepting for supervision frequency. And I want to confirm that One of the things that comes up with that, and so maybe Ms. Galvin, you can help us with that language just so that we're clear. One of the things that comes up with that is that the supervision frequency as defined by the BACB has changed. And so an individual that maybe did their supervision in 2017 has a different frequency requirement by the BACB than an individual that did their supervision this year. And so my question for that would be, do we look to the BACB during that time period, or is it the time period that the BACB is defining today? And I'll tell you that the BACB's definition of observation in 2017 was once every 2-week period. The definition now is twice every month-long period. So just a little bit of verbiage change. It's still twice a month, but rather than once every 2 weeks, it now can fall twice any time within that month. But I want to make sure that when we're reviewing applications that we know what it is that we're applying that section to when it comes to whether or not observations occurred.
You will have to apply the requirements that are in place at the time the application is pending.
Okay. And I don't see a problem with that unless board's other committee members do, because the requirements actually loosened a little bit, I would say. I think anybody who had it every 2 weeks obviously would meet the current requirement, but I wanted to clarify on that just to be sure.
Yeah, if the verbiage has gone from every 2 weeks to twice a month, then I would agree with your interpretation that when those individuals met every 2 weeks, then they still meet the requirements of twice a month.
Perfect. Excellent. And I have one other question regarding the matter. When it comes to circumstances in which we are made aware, because this is something that comes to mind for me, is that we have the experience form that goes to the BACB doesn't ask the question about whether observations occurred at the appropriate frequency. It would come under a supervision audit from the BACB. Now, our supervision form does ask the question. And so I see two potential conflicts. One is we have in there that we will accept the BACB form. So are we missing that question but requiring it for some applicants, but missing it for others? And then the other concern that I have is in a circumstance where we are made aware that supervision did not occur, what is then our obligation to report that back to the BACB?
I don't know if you're addressing that to me. I think I would have to look into that a little bit more.
Okay.
Because I don't know what your obligation would be to report that back.
Okay. Well, that part's fine. The first part of that question, and I don't know if board staff, is it a, I guess the question, and I think Ms. Galvin, you're still the one to answer or potentially direct me in the right resource. But I'm so concerned about the fact that our supervisor form asks a question that the BACB supervisor form does not. Which means that one of two things is happening. We either have people who aren't being expected to report that answer, and therefore we wouldn't know. But then on that flip side, for people who are using the psychology board form, they're being expected to answer that question. Is that a problem? Like that conflict a problem?
Yeah, and I need to look into that.
Okay.
I guess I would want to sit down with the requirements and the forms and take a closer look at that.
Okay. That sounds, I mean, I don't know how the other committee members feel about it, but I think it would be helpful just so that there's consistency and continuity across applicants. I think it would be helpful, but I would welcome any comments or feedback from other board or committee members. All right, hearing none, I'm going to go ahead and move to agenda item number 8, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding continuation of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners and proposed legislation, including but not limited to a whole slew of bills. Ms. Pakadon, can you provide us a summary?
Certainly, Madam Chair. I don't have much of an update for the committee. You may recall reading bulletins sent by me in the past where at first it appeared that the legislature was going to return from the recess. They went into a recess status on March 23rd. They had intended to return after 3 weeks, and then they, the leadership had discussed that there was an agreement that they would return simply to sign a die and conclude the session. Then there were other reports of members wanting to come and finish the unfinished work. There were reports of certain members wanting to have a very small and focused session specific to the COVID-19 outbreak. And that last report, today was the day that the legislature was going to convene to consider all of these options and make a decision. And that decision, they're not meeting today. They've decided to wait even farther into the month of May to decide when to come together and what course of action to take. So what the implications that I think this committee is most concerned about would be House Bill 2224, which, as we know, establishes fingerprint requirements, made some changes to BA licensure requirements, and then also the accommodation, if you will, the temporary accommodation for the former students of the Argosy psychology program. That bill, along with hundreds of others, is simply still in suspension mode. So we don't know, we can't predict at this time its fate, unfortunately.
Excellent, thank you. Are there any committee members that have any questions for Ms. Pakadon? Hearing none, it does sound like we have had a couple of other people join us. I'm assuming that they might be representatives from the Professional Association. May we ask
Madam
who
Chair.
Has joined the call?
Madam Chair, this is Dr. Davey. I was actually kicked off the call and had to redial in, and so I was one of the beeps. It only took me maybe 30 seconds to reconnect.
Okay.
Madam Chair, this is a... Yeah, this is Dr. Senhoff. I had the same event happen as Dr. Davey.
Excellent. Okay, so no new people have joined the call that we're aware of. Perfect. Did you guys need Ms. Pakadon to provide additional summary? In summary, there is not really any updates on those bills, as COVID-19 has also halted much of the legislative processes as well. Did you guys need any additional summary of that or any questions or comments?
Madam Chair, I think your summary would suffice for the summary.
I think Ms. Pakadon has done a great job sending emails and keeping everybody in the loop, so I think we're all aware.
I agree.
Dr. Davey, did you have a comment as well?
No, I appreciated the update. Thank you.
Excellent. All right, then we're going to go ahead and move forward with item number 9, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recent updates from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. Ms. Pakadon, would you like to provide us a summary?
Yes, Madam Chair, this is a standing agenda item, an opportunity for the committee members to discuss the information that BACB shares with us that is on regulatory topics, regulatory issues. So my course of action is to supply you with those, with that information. And you have everything with the exception of some very recently issued updates, both late yesterday and this morning. BACB has shared that the Pearson View test centers are opening in states that are permitting them to be opened. And so that's sort of something that Ms. Folks is going to have to, you know, try to manage, because there are going to be variations from state to state. And I know from talking to some of my colleagues in the testing world, there have this rollout process and the availability of appointments, which is still very small because of distancing requirements, but the rollout has been really bumpy, and candidates are struggling with canceled appointments and with system issues preventing them from scheduling. So I don't think that impacts this committee and the board directly, but it's just something to be aware of.
Excellent, thank you. One other update that I wanted to address was, it came out earlier this week, and I see some potential conflict with what the BACB has sent out and what's allowable by our rules. And so I wanted to have a conversation about that. And so essentially what has happened with COVID-19 is that many of the students and supervisees have been forced to reallocate their time away from direct patient time, which, if you recall, in our current standards, we have 1,500 hours with only 50% of that being direct patient time, or direct implementation. And so we already have within the standards that the other 50% of their experience has to be in what's considered unrestricted hours, which could be training, it could be data analysis, it could be a slew of approved activities. What has happened with COVID-19 is the restrictions in patient time has resulted in the supervisees having an impact, a drastic impact, in their ability to get those two client observations every month. And so the BACB released a point of guidance that basically said that the BACB will be waiving the requirement for patient observations or client observations in the event that a supervisee does not have access to clients. And so what that would mean is that the BACB is going to allow those individuals to continue to accrue their unrestricted hours. So they could be doing data analysis, graphing, protocol development, programs, helping with scoring assessments or what have you. And those hours in the month would still count, even though they wouldn't be having their observation. It's similar to what we talked about in an earlier agenda item. My concern is that while we have in there that the BACB supervision, or that supervision will occur at a frequency approved by the BACB, my concern is that may not cover the requirement when it comes to those that are seeking supervision right now, because hopefully by the time they become certified and apply for licensure, the state of emergency will be over. And so my concern is we're going to have a slew of applicants who are potentially accruing hours without observations that may at a later date be interpreted as not meeting the rule. The BACB has come out and said, hey, if all you're doing is unrestricted hours and you don't have contact with clients, cool, your supervisor needs to fill out this waiver form every month indicating what it was that you were doing and that you, and confirming you didn't have access to clients. I think that some of the community has gotten really creative in redefining clients. So when you look at our ethics, clients and patients aren't the same. And so they're doing a lot of staff training. They're doing a lot of practicing parent training and role play scenarios, things like that, to where the supervisors are still physically able to observe them with a staff member or what have you. But my concern is that by the BACB simply sending this out, that there might be a discrepancy in what is allowable for licensure and what's allowable by the BACB. So I wanted to open that up for discussion and maybe Ms. Galvin, I don't know if you have any suggestion. I don't know if this is something we can issue a substantive policy about to address, if it's something that can fall under executive orders on the COVID-19 stuff already. I mean, I'm kind of at a loss here, but I'm concerned at the long-term implications of this.
Well, it's not on the agenda. So I would recommend that we put it on a future agenda for discussion.
So because it's one of the recent updates that came out, all we can do is discuss it. We just can't take action on it.
I'm a little hesitant. Let me.
Because I completely understand what you're saying. I was curious more so with item number 7 and item number 9. If
okay, I'm okay. I guess it's broad enough.
Yeah, and I'm okay with moving it back to 7 if you think that one is more, I mean, we can revisit item number 7 again if that's more suitable for the topic. The BACB just released it, I want to say, on Monday or Tuesday, so it is brand new information from the BACB.
And I would like to explore, I think a substantive policy statement could be issued given the recent publication of this, the changes that are happening very rapidly because of COVID, how they're starting to interpret requirements and kind of get some flexibility with them. So I would be happy to work with anyone who you designate and Heidi and see if we can draft a substantive policy statement that would address this.
Okay. Committee members, any questions, comments? Is this something any of you are interested in working on, or would you like for me to work with the board staff and Ms. Galvin on it? Did my summary make sense? I hope that it was kind of clear where I think the concern may be.
Madam Chair, if I can ask, just for clarification, you aren't suggesting that this is a matter you would want to address through a waiver. You're suggesting something entirely different?
I'm not sure the best way to address it. I think, and that might be where Ms. Galvin would need to explore, I don't know, the substantive policy or a waiver, because my concern is that the people that this is almost like the Argosy students in the fact that, so maybe it is a waiver, in the fact that we're just going to have a period of time where due to the state of emergency, not any other reason, and the BACB has made it clear that it's specific to no access to clients because of the COVID-19. I'm happy to address it either way, but we're going to have a period of time from, you know, Monday or Tuesday of this week to when the state of emergency ends, in which supervisees may not meet the rule as it's defined because of the state, the COVID-19. So, I mean, if there's a better way than a substantive policy, I just want it to be addressed in such a way that we're aligned with the BACB. We're allowing for the indirect, since the indirects are allowed anyway, but understanding, because what I would hate is for all of these supervisees to have to just stop their programs entirely when they have 750 hours that have to be done doing those activities anyway. So I think halting their supervision because the statutory requirements in the state, I think that that's problematic. I would like to for us to have some solution in place, whether that's a waiver or a substantive policy, some solution in place to allow for them to continue those you know, 750, and that's a minimum of 750 unrestricted hours. The only one that has a maximum is that direct patient time, that would allow for them to continue accruing their time so that they're not having to get different hours at a later time. I mean, it's a substantial amount of individuals who will be affected.
It sounds like it might be better for a waiver, given your description, and it is very similar to the Argosy students. And what might be best is for the committee to vote to allow the board and allow you to present to the board a request a waiver of this requirement, given what's happening, and go from there. I think that's probably the most advisable. Hello.
This is Dr. Stenhoff. I'm still online.
This is Dr. Race. I'm still here.
So I don't know if my comment was heard, but I suggested maybe the committee take a vote to recommend that the board seek a waiver of these direct supervision requirements, given the circumstances surrounding COVID-19. And then Heidi and I and Dr. Davis-Wilson can work on that waiver, present it to the board at an upcoming meeting, and move forward from there.
This is Heidi. I'm looking at the summary of the previously adopted and approved waivers. And I think that we could probably borrow some language from some of those listed, starting with letter P. Maybe that can be, take some of that language and formulate that into a motion. Not sure if there's any better example.
Hi, sorry, I got disconnected. All right, can everybody hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I caught what Galvin was saying, and I was actually making a motion, so I'll go ahead and repeat it if nothing else has been done. But I was making a motion to allow for me to work with board staff and Ms. Galvin and move forward with a request of a waiver for the full board to address the supervised experience requirements in light of COVID-19. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
And then a second. All in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Galvin. I appreciate the support and the guidance.
No problem.
All right. We will move now to item number 10, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding order issued by the Arizona Department of Economic Security, Division of Developmental Disabilities, parents temporarily becoming direct care workers during the COVID-19 emergency. in light of COVID-19, one of the solutions that DESCDD has come to with regards to families being without work, families being without caregivers for their individuals with developmental disabilities, is to allow for the parents to become paid providers for the child. Now, for much of the work, it's not horrendously a conflict. For example, they're unable to provide respite, but they are able to provide attendant care. They are able to provide habilitation. One of the little caveats of habilitation is that there is an early intervention habilitation program that is housed under the habilitation rules that do require a BCBA's oversight. And so there's a little bit of a concern and a conflict because what has happened is that the department has provided the information to the family. Families are seeking employment to become those direct care workers. But there, within the community, there's some obvious concern around the potential of conflict of interest and dual or multiple relationships. So I bring this to your attention. I'm pretty sure most of you are familiar with the Early Childhood Autism Program. That program is a program that, you know, it was piloted in 2006. It became a permanent service in 2009 after some legislation passed requiring a service of its kind. When it became a service, a permanent service in 2009, it was a walking ethical nightmare. Many of us that were trying to deal with the services, it was very difficult between the direct care worker and the BCBA, in that the direct care worker could be a sibling or a grandparent, or it could really be anybody the family's choosing, and then we were expected to go in there and train them up, you know, up to the treatment plan and up to fidelity to get them to implement the plan. So that caused a lot of advocacy and public policy work where we push for the requirement of the providers to not be a family member and for the providers to be with the same agency as the BCBA, because that was one of the other issues, is that I could be the BCBA, but the people providing the direct care, the 25 hours, 40 hours a week, could be from a whole different agency. So I would go in there to train them, and they would say, "You're not my boss." So we had this conflict where I, as the BCBA, was responsible for the client's progress. I had to report on it every 3 months. I had to request the hours. I was responsible for all of that, but I was met with these barriers of being told I'm not their boss, they were family members, you know, the state didn't really enforce the fact they weren't running our treatment program. So in 2014, we were successful in getting the state to getting DDD to allow or to restrict that part of habilitation to not being family members, and the individual had to be from the same agency, so that we had some sort of contingencies in place to enforce the treatment plan. Now, there are a lot of mental health parity concerns with the program. There's a lot of still kind of borderline ethical, questionable issues with the program as it's defined. And so BCBAs have worked very, very diligently to navigate that particular habilitation program. And ultimately what we decided on was a recommendation to move all of the ABA services at Behavior Health and to dissolve the early childhood program altogether. So families would still have access to it, but it would be housed under the behavior health policies, which then reference 32-2091, which is our licensing, so that we had better alignment with the professional obligations of our profession and what's necessary to ensure proper care to the consumers, because having DDD in the middle of that created a bunch of things where DDD would have policies in conflict with our ethics. So we made that recommendation, and as you are all aware, they can't just abruptly stop the program. So the program was set to sunset in October of this year. It was set to sunset in June. They moved it to October. Nonetheless, the division has agreed to do away with this program. But now we're in this really agreeing with all of the reasons that we have cited as why the program is extremely problematic for families. It's problematic for the professionals. They've come to a consensus with us on that and have agreed to sunset the program. Now, in light of this new guidance from DDD, DDD has included the early childhood program as being the eligible program for a parent to work through. So we're kind of back to where we were back in 2009, where we're writing programs and doing training of family members and or parents. The conflict now is that those parents are now being employed by the same agency as the behavior analyst. And so so I wanted to bring it to the committee's attention, possibly something we need to bring to the board's attention, but I've got several thoughts on the matter and several both concerns, but also some kind of grace knowing the history of the program, which is why I went through the history of the program, is because this program hasn't been an ideal program for the population from the get-go. But I wanted to open up the discussion for the committee and then see kind of where we want to go with this, because it's a very, very controversial situation, and I think that it could lead to future issues. Any thoughts, questions?
I hear everything you're saying, and these are extremely difficult times across the board for so many families that receive medical care and behavioral health services. And I do think the kinds of things we can do to knock down barriers for the foreseeable future are important. I think we have to just make sure that we're operating with Ms. Galvin's guidance in these areas to make sure that we're not overstepping or setting up ourselves for challenges moving forward. But I do think the things that we can do, we should be actively looking at to provide assistance.
Agreed. I mean, I think the difficult part, and Ms. Galvin, I think this isn't something that I think we're going to have a resolution today. I think this is kind of just an introduction of the, oh, wow. I think the interesting part about it is that I'm struggling to come to the conclusion that simply a parent working for the same organization that I work for is enough to constitute a statutory violation. I think that we have literature to support parent-implemented programming. We have literature to support this. I will tell you that in the current program, the turnover of HAB providers is so frequent that oftentimes what happens is we get in there and we get the basics of ABA taught, and then they're gone, and we've got a whole new provider, and so we never get up and going with them because they never get to a point where they're meeting competencies enough for us to have them running the program. And so when I compare the two and I think, wow, we could have parents that are trained that, you know, can generalize this, you know, when this order is up, they'll be able to continue with the child. You know, the parents aren't leaving or going anywhere. But I think there has to be very, very strategic plans around how people navigate that multiple relationship, that their informed consents need to be solid, that there needs to be solid avenues for reporting, like the BCBA can't serve as the supervisor, or even in some programs, the habilitation providers aren't even in the same department as the BCBAs. And so the BCBAs may be overseeing the program, but they're not in any way connected. And I think that's the part I mean, I don't know how much guidance we can provide or what we can do proactively, but what I would hate to have happen is I would hate to have behavior analysts do everything in their power to remediate any potential multiple relationship, and it just come down to the board's interpretation that that parent working for that agency or being paid automatically makes the conflict. But that's the fear that's there. The fear that's there right now is that if the parent gets paid by the agency, it's automatically a multiple relationship. And that's the thing that I'm concerned about. Yeah, go right ahead.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say perhaps one path we can look at, and I would defer to Ms. Galvin on the matter, is if you look at some of the things coming out from the Inspector General with regard to HIPAA, some of the things coming out with regard to telehealth practices and good faith, that they are essentially, they're not suspending the rules, but they are looking at loosening up enforcement. They've used some different terminology to kind of push that out to the public. I'm wondering if some sort of, policy, a substantive policy statement to that effect would provide some wiggle room for those that need to be able to access provider services, direct services in that manner. And I'm just wondering if we could look at some of the other things that are coming out with regard to loosening some of the more strict rules during this crisis. If Ms. Galvin has anything she thinks that might be helpful or may serve as a template, maybe we could review that and take a look.
I don't obviously have anything prepared today, but that is something that I would be happy to work on with, staff and a member or two of the committee. I do want to give some thought as to what the board's role, the committee's role would be in all of this, to ensure that we're not, stepping into an area where we typically don't, interface with.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And Dr. Davey, I agree. I like kind of your outlook on it. And I agree, to kind of work, with Ms. Galvin, because the reason why I like what you're suggesting, Dr. Davey, is because my concern, I don't want to be in a position where as a board or a committee, we're making recommendations or defining multiple relationships or, doing those sorts of things, because those are case by case reviews. But essentially what you're suggesting is, again, some sort of way that we could have a little bit of a good faith, a language, to allow, because, when I think about the telehealth and HIPAA restrictions, like that is still under good faith for a temporary amount of time, and best practice is still to align yourself with those requirements to the best of your ability. And so I think that I agree with you. I don't want to be overly prescriptive. I don't want to make decisions that is outside of the authority of the board. But my bigger concern comes in from, thinking a year from now, all this is over or whatever, and a complaint comes forth, and people are like, wait, hold on. Who was getting paid for what and what was happening? And so now that could already be the case, because just because there's good faith and you've got, I think we've, as a field, got enough tools available to us to be able to address this and still meet our standards of practice, still address the multiple relationships issue. So those tools are available. I would expect that by us having something like what you're suggesting, it would, one, encourage licensees to explore those tools, make sure those things are in place, but two, allow for a little bit of that kind of grace around over prescribing this as automatically being a multiple relationship issue. I think that's where I'm concerned, is what I'm hearing in the community is this automatically is being assumed at the surface to be a multiple relationship issue. And if that's the case, then why do we have parent implemented treatment to begin with?
And typically, the board doesn't get involved in, you know, hypothetical cases. Mm-hmm. It's not until a complaint comes to us alleging that there is a multiple relationship or some other kind of unprofessional conduct do we then assess whether the conduct was appropriate versus kind of getting out in front of it and making a proclamation that this indeed would constitute a multiple relationship. I think we
absolutely
have
to be- and- Sorry, and yes, I do want to avoid prescribing that. Like, I want to avoid coming out and stating one way or another as well.
Yeah, I was also say, Madam Chair, that, you know, this issue may be something that we work collaboratively with in terms of DDD access. You know, and maybe we need to, you know, maybe we need to have a discussion with them about their policy statement around this as well, because that could also provide some guidance that the agency that essentially provides government oversight to how those dollars are spent and ultimately has audit power over those and has fiduciary duty to that, their statement would likely weigh heavily on any decision that the board may have to make on somebody brought before us on a complaint. To Ms. Gavin's point, you know, we wouldn't have to act on something unless it was brought forward to us. And so that kind of documentation coming forward from the state Medicaid program, specifically access, I think would definitely weigh heavily on any decision to move forward with a complaint versus dismissing it outright.
And Dr. Davey, I would agree with that. And I think the documentation they've already provided, I mean, in order for DDD to make this sort of decision, access, well, I shouldn't speculate, but usually access is aware of these decisions. And I think that all that's fine. I would be comfortable with us keeping this documentation. I think it's clear. I think it makes sense. It is what it is. And then, like I said, from a perspective of just understanding the complaint process and understanding the tools available for behavior analysts, I mean, I'm even okay with just waiting and addressing it as it comes up. Because I think on a case by case basis, the circumstances could vary. I wanted it to be brought to everybody's attention so that they're aware that this is present and this is something that is happening and it is creating a lot of conflict. But I also would agree that no two circumstances are created equal. And I can think of a million scenarios that could be in favor of this, and I can think of a million scenarios that could not. And whether or not that's the case that's presented before us, we wouldn't know until that moment. But I think it's important to be aware that this is present and has conflict associated with it. And I would even be okay with us just kind of having it here, having it noted for the record, and maybe holding on to it as one of the many things that came out with COVID-19 that should something come up in a year or 2 years from now that we can refer back to.
Yeah. I'm sure I think this discussion here is public record and something that can be noted as well and referenced, you know, to the discussion as well as our concerns, as well as kind of our thoughts, you know, kind of serves as the record with the discussion, should something need to be moved forward. Maybe Ms. Gavin can, note this discussion somewhere that we could pull it quickly in the future as well. But yeah, I mean, this is all very new to everybody, and I think, you know, we're just all trying to find our way and make sure we're not creating havoc in the months and years to come. So it's a great discussion.
Yeah, and I agree, Dr. Davia. And like I said, my biggest concern is that it is kind of the over prescription of terminology, because I can sit and see both sides of it, and I can envision perfectly in my head of a perfect case scenario for this that's a fail and one that's a success. And so I think that it's important. So I guess that to summarize why I wanted to have this conversation is that it's important that one, we as a board continue to take the stance that this isn't a one size fit all and that circumstances, you know, will be reviewed when they come up, but to also encourage the licensees to look at everything from a lens of standards of practice and best practice. And again, we have so many tools available to us to mitigate the potential risks associated with this, that I guess my overarching concern still remains that the community, you know, hustle and bustle about it is an over defining of something that may actually put the public at risk, because there may be children who need additional services or families who have lost their job because their child is not in school and they need that support. And so I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't anything or if there was, what we would be doing to make sure that level of, and maybe it is just built in our process, but that level of circumstantial evidence at the time remains a priority, so that we're not in a position of people, I mean, I don't know how much within the community you guys have heard, but there's been, I mean, some blatant, not so nice things said about other behavior analysts regarding decisions that they're all making around this issue. And I think that my concern, again, is more of, you know, how do we make sure that we're having these discussions and how do we stay true to the fact that our role is to address the circumstances as they are presented in front of us, and that there isn't a black and white answer to any of this, because that's the answer people are seeking, a black and white answer right now, and others are attempting to provide it, and it's causing a lot of conflict. And I think, unfortunately, it's at the expense of the children and the families involved. So, and I do also, one other thing I just want to throw out there as a concern that I have with this policy, just as a general statement, it's most definitely nothing that we can do, is that if you read the bottom of it, it just has, for transition, that at the end of the COVID-19 emergency, DDD will rescind this exception and parents are no longer able to provide the care. All policies return back to before the pandemic. I just, in general, you know, and I made a statement earlier, I mean, this is, my heart goes out to the families that are being faced with this, because an abrupt stop to anything in this population that they're serving is extremely traumatic. And so I'm very concerned about this policy in general, but again, it's not necessarily a board issue, but as a parent of a child with special needs, I'm living the day to day of what these unexpected and turmoil is creating for these children, and I'm concerned at this approach, and not again, just the approach in general, not specific to the behavior analytics side, which I will stand firm to the fact that I think that there are great cases to show that this is possible and great cases to show that this is a conflict, and we're just going to have to address them as if, and you know, if they come in and what the circumstances of that individual case is. All right, that's my soapbox. Any other questions or comments from any other committee members? Ms. Galvin, does that, I know I just kind of rambled, but does that kind of sound good to you that we just kind of note this for the record? We've had the conversation, and perhaps, you know, we revisit it should a complaint come up that may reflect this time period.
Yes, and gather whatever information. It sounds like you have already have started to do that, but then the board will maintain it, because obviously that could inform the committee at a later date if a complaint is filed.
Perfect.
It'll give us context as to how the behavior analyst was, you know, conducting him or herself.
Okay. I appreciate that. And thank you, Dr. Davey. I appreciate your input on it as well. All righty. Hearing no other questions or comments, I am going to move on to agenda item number 11, new agenda items for future meetings. Do we have any topics for future meetings?
I think, Madam Chair, I think maybe we just add an item that might be fairly broad but is related to both licensure regulatory issues as they relate to the COVID-19 health crisis, which would allow us some latitude to have discussions very similar to the one today that are impacting our need to provide guidance to licensees as well as to follow the guidelines in which the governor's office and other healthcare professionals in the state are providing to us.
Excellent. I agree with that. I think that that would be a good standing item, board staff, if you wouldn't mind, so that we can have these conversations because so much information is firing quickly.
Yes, indeed, Madam Chair.
And then I believe we will have for the future agenda potential summary of the response from the full board on that request for the waiver for the supervision requirement. So that will likely need to be on a future agenda as well.
Yes.
We did talk about having kind of a standing item for stakeholder communication. I don't know if we want to, that wasn't on this week's agenda, which is fine, but I don't know if we want to add that or if everybody's just kind of okay addressing it as things come up. Any thoughts on that of whether we want to continue with that recommendation to have the standing item for discussing stakeholder communication, or if we want to just address issues as they come up? All right, hearing none. Oh. Sorry about that. Unexpected interruption. Hearing none, I mean, I'm okay with Ms. Pacnon. I don't know where you are. You know, we had it on the agenda the last three meetings. I think we were able to discuss a lot of strategies. I think there's some additional strategies that could be discussed, but I also don't want to beat a dead horse, so I'm fine just addressing it as issues come up, unless anybody else disagrees.
I'm comfortable with that.
Okay. And I think that's all I had. Does anybody else have any other future agenda items? Hearing none, we will go ahead and move to item number 12. We have a motion to adjourn.
I'll make it a motion to adjourn.
I'll second.
We have a motion. Do we have a motion and a second? All in favor, aye.
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 And it is 11:24, and this meeting has been adjourned. Thank you guys for all of your time today.
Thank you. Be careful. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.